Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
Thanks for having me back.
Of course. So I want you to consider a question. How could tracing the male-specific Y chromosome completely rewrite the history of human migration? Like, literally overturning long-held theories about who lived where and when.
Right, it's a massive shift.
Exactly. I want you to imagine what really happens when we stop relying solely on the maternal side of ancient genetics and, you know, finally unlock the paternal genome.
It's basically like we've been looking at human history with one eye closed this whole time, and now we're finally opening the other one.
Which is wild to think about.
Yeah.
And before we get into the weeds, today we celebrate the work of Tuomas Kiviseld, the University of Cambridge, and the Estonian BioCenter, who have advanced our understanding of human Y chromosome variation through ancient DNA.
Yeah, their work is just incredibly foundational for this whole field.
It really is. So we're doing a deep dive today into a collection of recent genomic studies.
Mm-hmm.
And our mission here is to understand exactly how scientists are, well, pulling this male-specific DNA right out of the dirt.
Which is not easy, by the way.
I can imagine. And we want to see why those findings are forcing us to basically redraw the entire map of ancient human history. Because, you know, we have been sequencing ancient DNA for a while now.
Right, for decades, actually. But ancient DNA studies were heavily, I mean, almost exclusively skewed toward mitochondrial DNA or mtDNA.
And why is that? Because it was easier?
Basically, yeah. There is a very practical biochemical reason for that bias. So every single cell in your body has a nucleus, right?
That's right. Yeah, like a secure vault holding the DNA.
Exactly. And if you're male, that vault contains one single copy of the Y chromosome, just one. But outside that nucleus, floating around in the cell fluid, are mitochondria, the energy factories.
Right, the powerhouse of the cell. Everyone remembers that from high school biology.
Exactly. And a single cell has just one nucleus, but it can have hundreds or even thousands of copies of mitochondrial DNA.
Oh, wow, thousands.
Thousands. So if you're picturing an archaeological dig, right, when you pull a bone out of the ground that is, say, 40,000 years old, the DNA inside is going to be incredibly degraded.
So you're just statistically way more likely to find a surviving piece of the mitochondrial DNA.
Exactly, because the sheer volume of it was thousands of times higher to begin with.
That makes total sense.
Yeah, and that sheer volume is what made early ancient DNA research even possible. But the catch is, mitochondrial DNA is passed down strictly from mother to child.
Right, so by relying solely on it, we were only tracing maternal lineages.
Yes. We could see the mother's migrations, but the father's movements were just completely invisible to us.
It's like trying to read a history book where the pages describing all the father's lineages have just been ripped out.
That is a perfect analogy. We literally only had the mother's pages.
But now, thanks to high-throughput sequencing, or HTS, we're finally reading those missing pages. We can sequence ancient Y chromosomes, or AY as it's sometimes called, and get that male-specific non-recombining counterpart to the maternal story.
Right, which lets us see the full demographic picture.
Right.
But getting that Y chromosome data is, well, it's a huge challenge. The Y chromosome is haploid, meaning there's only that one copy per cell.
I understand there is only one copy, but why is the Y chromosome itself uniquely challenging to read? Even if we find that one copy, shouldn't our modern sequencing machines just, you know, decode it?
You would think so, but the architecture of the Y chromosome itself is just a bioinformatic nightmare.
A nightmare? How so?
Well, it is incredibly repetitive. It contains these huge stretches of DNA that just repeat the exact same sequences over and over and over.
Oh, I see.
And when we sequence ancient DNA, we don't get one long, continuous strand. It's all broken up. We get tiny, shattered fragments, usually only like 30 to 50 base pairs long.
So trying to map those repetitive fragments back together is like, I don't know, trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle where 500 pieces are the exact same shade of blue sky.
Yes. You wouldn't know if a piece belongs on the left side of the puzzle or the right side because they look absolutely identical.
That sounds incredibly frustrating.
It is. And to make matters worse, the Y chromosome shares a high degree of sequence homology with the X chromosome.
Wait, homology? meaning they look the same.
Yeah, large chunks of the Y look virtually identical to the X chromosome.
Wait, let me stop you there, because I can see a massive problem with that.
I bet you can.
Right. If you are analyzing a female skeleton who has two X chromosomes, and those X chromosomes look just like the Y, couldn't the sequencing machine just get confused and think it's seeing a male lineage?
It absolutely will get confused. You will get false positive Y signals in female remains if you aren't incredibly rigorous.
Wow. So how do they fix that?
Researchers have to deploy these really advanced bioinformatic algorithms to actively filter out those highly repetitive regions. And they have to filter out the regions that are homologous to the X chromosome.
So they have to tell the software, like, only look for the uniquely mapping regions of the Y.
Exactly. They have to zero in on the tiny slivers of the puzzle that don't look like anything else.
And all of this filtering is happening on DNA that is already, well, rotting.
Right.
Because the sources mention post-mortem damage, where the DNA chemically alters as it just sits in the dirt.
Yeah, over thousands of years, there's this chemical process called deamination that occurs.
Deamination.
Basically, the nucleotide cytosine degrades into thymine. And guanine degrades into adenine.
Okay, so a C turns into a T and a G turns into an A.
Exactly. So when a scientist reads a T in the sequencer, they have a massive problem on their hands.
Because they have to figure out if this is a genuine historical genetic mutation, like something that tells them who this person is related to, or if it's just chemical rot from sitting in a cave for 30,000 years.
Precisely.
So how do they actually solve that? Because it sounds like you would never be able to trust a single mutation you find.
It's brilliant, actually. Bioinformaticians turned that exact problem into the ultimate authentication tool.
Wait, they use the rod as a tool?
Yeah, because DNA doesn't rot evenly. It degrades at a highly predictable rate at the very ends of the broken fragments.
Oh, interesting.
So researchers trained algorithms to look for that specific elevated pattern of C to T damage just at the tips of the DNA reads. If that damage pattern is present, it actually proves the DNA is genuinely ancient.
Wow. So if the damage isn't there, you know the DNA is modern contamination.
Exactly. It's likely from the archaeologist who dug it up or someone in the lab. The damage is literally how we know the data is real.
That is fascinating. So we have this incredible treasure trove of genetic history locked in the Y chromosome, but it's hidden behind repetitive junk DNA, disguised as the X chromosome and degraded by thousands of years of rot.
That's the reality of ancient DNA, yeah.
So how do you physically pull a single damaged needle out of that genetic haystack? The sources outline two main physical methods: shotgun sequencing and hybridization capture.
Right, so shotgun sequencing is kind of the brute force approach.
Okay, how does that work?
You take whatever DNA you can extract from the bone, you blast it into millions of fragments, sequence every single thing in there, and then use software to map it back to a reference human genome.
Just sequence everything and sort it out later.
Pretty much. And the primary advantage of the shotgun method is that it is completely non-biased. It sequences whatever is physically there.
Which means it can discover entirely new, uncharacterized, or even extinct genetic lineages that we didn't even know existed.
Yes, exactly.
But I'm struggling with this part. If shotgun sequencing is completely unbiased and can find extinct lineages, why don't we just use that all the time? Why bother with anything else if this gives us the whole unbiased picture?
Two words. Soil bacteria. Yeah, if a bone is 40,000 years old, the vast majority of the DNA inside it is not human anymore. It is environmental.
So it's mostly just dirt microbes.
Exactly. If a sample is, say, 99% bacterial DNA, shotgun sequencing is going to waste 99% of your computing power, your time, and your budget sequencing prehistoric bacteria.
And you might spend a fortune and only get a handful of actual human Y chromosome reads.
Exactly. Which is where the second method comes in, hybridization capture, specifically using arrays like the HO1240K.
The HO1240K, that's the solution for highly degraded samples, right?
Right. Capture-based methods act like a molecular magnet. So instead of sequencing the bacteria, researchers design synthetic probes that specifically target known single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs.
Okay, SNPs.
Yeah, and that HO1240K array, it targets over 32,000 specific Y chromosome markers.
Oh, wow.
So you drop these synthetic probes into the ancient DNA soup, and they chemically bind only to the human Y chromosome fragments. They literally pull out exactly what you are looking for, leaving all that bacterial DNA behind.
Okay, but isn't that inherently flawed?
How do you mean?
Well, If we only use capture arrays designed from modern DNA, like markers we already know exist because we see them in people living today, isn't that like looking for your lost keys only under the streetlight, just because that's where the light is?
The streetlight effect, yeah.
Right. Aren't we completely blind to any ancient lineage that just went extinct?
You have absolutely zeroed in on ascertainment bias, which is one of the most critical limitations discussed in this deep dive.
Ascertainment bias.
Yes. If an ancient population had a unique genetic branch that died out entirely, and we only use capture probes based on the genetics of modern survivors, we simply will not see that extinct branch.
So the algorithm just misses them.
It will either miss those ancient people entirely, or it will artificially force them into the closest modern parental category, which entirely obscures their unique history.
That is a massive blind spot.
It is. And it's exactly why shotgun sequencing is still fiercely prioritized whenever the sample preservation actually allows for it.
Okay, so we have our methods. We know how the bioinformaticians are pulling this data from the dirt, despite the challenges.
Right.
Let's talk about what this data actually reveals about the earliest peopling of Eurasia. Let's look at the oldest genomes recovered. Men who lived around 45,000 years ago.
Like the Ustishim man from Siberia and the Oase man from Romania.
Yes, those two.
These individuals represent some of the earliest anatomically modern humans in Eurasia that we have genetic data for. And both of these men belong to the root of haplogroup K.
Haplogroup K.
Yeah, and haplogroup K is incredibly important because it is ancestral to haplogroups N and O, which are massively widespread today across Eurasia. I mean, millions of men carry derivatives of this lineage.
But the profound discovery here, as I understand it, is that neither the Ustishim man nor the Oase man actually left any direct living descendants in their respective geographic regions.
Exactly.
Meaning they were the pioneers, they made it to Siberia and Romania, they survived long enough to leave remains, but their specific male lines just hit a dead end.
Right, they went extinct locally. The people who live in those regions today do not descend from them.
And the Kostenki 14 man is an even wilder example of this turnover. He lived about 37,000 years ago in what is now Russia.
Kostenki 14 is fascinating. He perfectly illustrates why the maternal and paternal lines must be studied together.
How so?
Well, if you look at his autosomal DNA, that's the DNA inherited from all your ancestors across both sides of your family tree, he is genetically very closely related to modern Europeans.
So based on that alone, you would assume he represents a stable population that just settled in Europe and stayed there.
You would.
I want you, the listener, to really picture this. Imagine taking a modern DNA ancestry test. Your results come back, and across your entire genome, you look completely European. But then you look at your direct, unbroken paternal line, your Y chromosome, and you find out your father's traced back to indigenous populations in Australia.
Right.
Because that is essentially what happened to Kostenki 14.
Right. Very close, yeah. His Y chromosome belonged to haplogroup C. And today, haplogroup C is virtually non-existent in Europe. You mostly find it thousands of miles away in Siberia, East Asia, and all the way down into Oceania.
That is just crazy. How does an early European end up with a paternal lineage that is now found in Oceania?
It proves that early Europe wasn't settled just once by a static group of hunter-gatherers. The male lineages present in Europe 37,000 years ago were largely wiped out, replaced, or heavily diluted by subsequent massive waves of migration.
So the autosomal DNA blended into the broader population over time, but that specific ancient paternal lineage was pushed out of Europe entirely.
Exactly.
And one of those massive waves of replacement was the early farmers.
Yes.
Because for tens of thousands of years, hunter-gatherers are roaming Europe. Then, around 8,000 years ago, people from Anatolia, modern-day Turkey, start showing up, and they bring agriculture.
And the Anatolian farmers didn't just bring wheat and domestic animals, they brought entirely new Y chromosomes, specifically haplogroups G and H.
So before this agricultural expansion, haplogroup G was just not really a thing in European hunter-gatherer populations?
Virtually non-existent. But as farming spread, so did haplogroup G.
Okay, here's a fun fact about that. Ötzi, the Tyrolean Iceman, the famous mummy found frozen in the Alps, is a perfect example of this.
Oh, absolutely.
The sources point out he belonged to haplogroup G2AL166. That molecular marker directly ties his paternal line back to those early Anatolian farmers. He is a walking, or rather frozen, artifact of that massive demographic shift.
He really is. But, you know, the story doesn't end with the farmers. Even Ötzi's lineage didn't maintain dominance.
Right.
Today, haplogroup G is quite rare across most of Europe. It mostly survives in geographically isolated pockets like the mountains of Sardinia or the Caucasus.
Because the farmers got replaced too, by the Bronze Age shift.
Exactly.
If you are listening to this right now and you have European ancestry, there is a massive statistical probability that your paternal line comes directly from the steppe migrations we are about to discuss.
Yeah, it's wild. Roughly 5,000 years ago, a culture known as the Yamnaya exploded out of the Pontic-Caspian steppe. That's roughly modern-day Ukraine and southern Russia.
And they swept across Europe in a demographic event that completely rewired the continent's genetics.
They brought with them haplogroups R1a and R1b.
And those are currently the most common paternal lineages in Europe today. But how did they pull that off? I mean, how does a group from the steppe just replace the farmers that had been established for thousands of years?
We see a dramatic, heavily male-driven demographic replacement. The Y chromosome data shows a stark turnover that the autosomal DNA alone didn't capture as violently.
Male-driven, so what were they doing differently?
Well, the Yamnaya had critical technological advantages. Wheeled wagons, horseback riding, and early bronze metallurgy. They were highly mobile pastoralists.
Wow.
The genetic data suggests these migrations were deeply sex-biased. It likely involved large groups of men moving into new territories, reproducing with the local female populations, and functionally erasing the local male lineages like haplogroup G.
So the modern European genetic landscape isn't really a legacy of the first hunter-gatherers, or even primarily the first farmers. It was heavily rewritten by Bronze Age men on horses.
That's what the Y chromosome tells us.
Let's follow these haplogroups further east. We are tracing the Y chromosome out of the Eurasian steppe across the Bering Strait and into the Americas, because this data is completely rewriting Native American history as well.
It really is. To understand the Americas, we actually have to look at a genome called the Multiboy. He's a 24,000-year-old individual found in Siberia.
Okay, Multiboy.
The Multiboy revealed a profound concept known as dual ancestry. His Y chromosome was a basal R lineage.
Wait, R lineage, like the ones that expanded into Europe with the Yamnaya?
Exactly. This is an extinct lineage that split off extremely early from the ancestors of modern haplogroups Q and R. So, meaning this boy in Siberia is related to West Eurasians.
Okay, but how does that tie into the Americas?
When researchers analyzed his full genome, the implications for the Americas were staggering. Modern Native Americans derive about one-third of their ancestry from a population related to this Multiboy, the West Eurasian side, and two-thirds of their ancestry from East Asians.
So the populations that eventually crossed the Bering Strait into the Americas weren't just one homogenous group from East Asia.
No, not at all.
They were already a complex genetic mix of deeply diverged Eurasian groups before they even set foot in the Americas.
Exactly. And we can trace the exact lineages that made that crossing through genomes like the Anzac boy.
Right. Associated with the Clovis culture in Montana, right?
Yeah.
About 12,600 years ago.
Yes. And the Kennewick man in Washington State from about 8,600 years ago.
And unlike the dead-end pioneers in early Europe we talked about earlier, these individuals show incredible continuity.
They do. Their Y chromosomes perfectly match the dominant Native American haplogroups today, Q1b and Q1a, respectively.
So it is direct physical proof that these specific male lineages were part of the earliest successful migrations into the Americas, and they have survived continuously for over 10,000 years.
Exactly. But just like in Europe, the Americas also saw instances of complete lineage extinction.
Like the Sakwak man.
Right. The Sakwak man was a 4,000-year-old genome recovered from Greenland. He belonged to a totally distinct Paleo-Eskimo migration. He carried haplogroup Q2BB143.
But that lineage vanished, right?
Entirely. The entire Paleo-Eskimo population was completely replaced by a later wave of Neo-Eskimos across the Arctic.
It's just constant turnover. The human story is not a simple family tree peacefully growing new branches. It's more like it's a ruthless game of genetic musical chairs where the music stops and entire populations, entire ancient lineages are continually replaced by whoever has the technological or demographic advantage to take the chair.
That's a great way to put it. Which means present-day genetic geography is actually a deeply flawed map for understanding where ancient people lived.
Because a haplogroup might be common in one region today simply because that is where it survived the various demographic bottlenecks, not because it originated there.
Exactly. The map of where people are now is not the map of where they've always been.
So what does this mean for the future of genomics? If we have this incredible tool now, where is the field heading next?
I think the future is really about synthesis. By combining Y chromosome data for the paternal line, mitochondrial DNA for the maternal line, and autosomal DNA for the whole picture, researchers can track sex-specific behaviors deep in prehistory.
Right, so we can differentiate between violent male-dominated expansions like the Yamnaya in the Bronze Age and whole population movements where families just migrated together.
Exactly. It adds a rich sociological layer to our biological history that we just didn't have before.
But there is a massive limitation to all the studies we've looked at today, isn't there? A huge geographic bias in the data.
Yeah, there is.
Because DNA preserves best in cold, dry, high-latitude environments. The permafrost is a fantastic freezer for ancient genetics.
It's the best preservative we could ask for.
Right. But because of that, our current map of ancient Y chromosomes is heavily skewed toward northern Eurasia and the Americas. The frozen north.
And that's a problem. We urgently need bioinformatic and chemical breakthroughs in extracting DNA from warm tropical climates. Africa, Southeast Asia, Oceania, these regions hold massive pieces of the human puzzle.
But the heat and humidity just degrade the DNA so rapidly.
Yeah, so rapidly that these regions are significantly underrepresented in the ancient DNA literature. It is really the next great frontier in paleogenomics.
The central insight of this deep dive is just undeniable. The sequencing of ancient Y chromosomes reveals that human history is defined by constant motion, dramatic population turnovers, and the frequent extinction of ancestral lineages.
It really is a story of constant change.
Yeah. The genetic makeup of modern populations is often a very recent development, meaning we cannot simply look at people living in a region today to understand who lived there tens of thousands of years ago.
Absolutely not.
It makes you wonder. If climate change and resource scarcity drive the next great wave of global migrations over the next century, what will the genetic map of our planet look like 1,000 years from now? Will our current lineages survive, or will we be replaced in the next round of genetic musical chairs?
It's a fascinating question to think about.
What does this mean for our understanding of human resilience and the fluid nature of our own ancestry?
Something to ponder, for sure.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
what stays, a wild map through ancient days.